Okay, yeah.
That's perfect. Let's get started for today. Working. Okay, today we'll discuss software security and operating system security as the last parts of the system security bunch of presentations. See. So we'll start software security now, and the second half will be on operating system security. Before I start, I sent out an announcement earlier this morning that there is a PhD defense tomorrow in Eureka on biometrics. So everybody could go, obviously, but those that are interested in biometrics or in taking the technology track, it could be even more interesting to join. Start the trial lecture at 10 o'clock, 10:15, sorry, 10:15 to 11, and then at 12:15 the actual presentation of the candidate's work will start. It's on iris perocular recognition. The actual presentation has 45 minutes to present. That's 12:15 to 1. After that, there is the questioning by the opponents, but obviously you're free to leave in between, of course. But it's interesting for those that have an interest in this topic. Okay, then something else, software security. Topics for today, and I'll go again. I'll follow the book here. So when we talk about software security, there, sure. I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe it's better to hear me. I mean, that's quite a distance. I don't know. I can't turn off something that might actually turn off the something for the There is interference? Okay, let me see if I can do something. I have no idea. Sorry? It's more hardware security then. I can't see any panel where I can do something. Yeah, but this is this you mean? This is just a projector. HDMI, so that's nothing. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea. Maybe I should not talk too loud. Security. Somehow I thought I would see something here also, but that's not the case. Yeah. Many of the vulnerabilities we'll see in software security are simply poor programming practices. Having errors in the code, not handling input very well, things like that. That can have obviously very severe consequences if not enough checking is done. Yeah, that could be used by attackers to get access to a system, to get access to information on the system. Actually, we'll consider three categories of software errors: insecure interaction, risky resource management, and porous defense. And there was a report that actually listed 25 of the most dangerous software errors and then grouped into these three categories. Often, when we talk about software, it's talk about quality and reliability and not so much security. And so what are the differences between the two? When we talk about security, we are interested in actually something that an attacker consciously does. Yeah, something very specific, some very specific input that he might give, or some very specific action. So the he is targeting a bug in the program, but in a very specific way, not a random way. Not like you are asking to give your name and instead you give your telephone number or something like that. Yeah, so he's targeting it in a very specific way. While when we talk about quality and reliability, we assume that users of the software use it in the appropriate way, but might make some errors in doing that. So the reliability, we want to improve, we want to remove as many bugs as possible, but actually what is done is not so much the number of bugs is important that is removed, but the number of times that a bug can occur. So the total number of occurrences of bugs should be minimized. While here, when we talk about security, we are looking at an input that significantly differs from what is expected. Adding scripts or whatever to an input where just a name or something is expected. Yeah, so dramatic changes of type of input. Normal type of approaches will look at, okay, what happens if my input is too long? Is there a check for that? Doesn't often really look at completely different different behavior of a user. defensive programming is actually making sure that we program as if we are being attacked, making sure that the program is able to recognize an attack and to react to that and react in a way that is controlled. The software should be able to detect that there is something wrong, should be able to detect that there is an attack, and then should react to that. Either it should ignore maybe faulty input or whatever, or it should, if it fails, it should do that in a graceful way. So not just terminate or whatever. It should make sure that this, the system in the very end is still secure, even though faulty execution is detected. The key rule here is to always check assumptions. So we assume nothing beforehand. When there is an assumption, we will check everything possible. Rather strange sense to never assume anything, always check assumptions. Well, if I never assume anything, I don't have assumptions. Another name is also secure program. And so that's what we should strive for. Secure programming is something that we can't do backwards. We should plan with that from the very first beginning when starting to program, of course. Programmers often make assumptions about the type of input that is received. Yeah, okay, I'm asking for a name. I'm expecting a name of a person. They're not expecting somebody to type something completely different. Add scripts or whatever, or try to overflow a buffer or whatever. Yeah. So these assumptions need to be validated in the program, and everything needs then to be handled with care. Either discard parts of the input that could be malicious, or anyways, to make sure that the program handles any input, any wrong input in a secure manner. Programmers have to understand how failures can occur. Yeah, understanding what can go wrong is obviously the first step into making a program secure. But there is obviously a conflict. If we program in a secure manner, then obviously we need to do more checking. We need to have more try to catch more of the wrong inputs and everything, and that will take more time. Programming needs to be more rigorous, which is in conflict with trying to push out the software and get revenues as soon as possible, obviously. Huh? So those two conflict each other. Security by design. When we start designing the software, we should build in security right from the start. Yeah, if we try to do it afterwards, it will always be more expensive, and there will always be things that will be forgotten. So security should be there from the very first beginning. It should be a design goal. It's done in many test modes, but in many engineering disciplines, but apparently programming is not that mature yet. There are some developments, however. There is Software Assurance Forum for Excellence in Code, SafeCode. So that's a forum to try and develop more secure software. Most of the errors will occur when handling input, but we'll also look at writing safe code and interaction with other programs or output and things like that. But the most vulnerable part of the software is actually handling the input from the user. Programmers often make assumptions about the maximum expected size of the input. We talked about buffer overflow last week. Yeah, I assume that somebody will just type a telephone number, which is 8 digits. Now, the fact that he types half a book is never considered. Yeah, maybe he makes an error, types 9 digits. Yeah. Allocated buffer size is often not confirmed, and that can result in the buffer overflow that we discussed. General testing might not find all the potential errors that we can encounter. And when we do safe coding, when we do secure coding, we have to treat every possible input as potentially dangerous. And not just an error of a user, but as something that could be on purpose by an attacker. Input can be binary or text. We don't know that. Depends on the encoding. Very user-specific in most cases. And the problem here is that there can be a variety of character sets. Yeah, before we had simply the letters A to Z, capital and normal size, 0 to 9, and some special characters. But adding more character sets from different kind of languages, yeah, extended that character set also. And we have to see how the program handles that. Yeah, if we don't validate the input in the correct way, then that could be a failure. One of the attacks that I want to discuss is the injection attack. And that is that's a flaw related to invalid handling of the input data. And so what we are trying to avoid is accidental or deliberate influence of flow to the flow of the execution of the program. Most often occurs in script languages. I'll have an example here. The idea here is that a user will present his name, and I'll have to find where here in this line. A user presents its name, and then some information about the user is presented. Yeah? But the way this program works here is just getting the name and then using it in the next line. Yeah. So if the input all of a sudden is not just a name, but a script that can be executed, yeah, or something else that can be executed, then you can get some faulty output. So, for example, here in the second output, not just a name was given. Actually, it was not even a name that was given. But using separation between commands, there was also an echo of attack successful and some other things that were, and a listing of files that was issued. Yeah, simply because the input here of the username was not checked to be just a simple input of a username or a simple input of a string, but actually contained special characters. Yeah, and so I guess it's hard to read, but it's in the book. If we check that the input indeed is conform what we want, just simple characters, then that would be good. Yeah, so we need to do checking of the input before we start using it in different commands. Here's another one, SQL. Here's again input for a name, and then there is in an SQL database some records are retrieved. But again, no check on the input here on the name. That's not here. There it is. No input on that value is done, and so that could again result in errors. Yeah, and so we could simply resolve that by checking that the input is something valid, something that could be processed, and nothing more or nothing less than that. So that was in injection attacks. Another kind of attack is cross-site scripting attacks, XSS. Here we actually use the fact that input from one user is output to another user. When I read that first, I thought that was strange. But think about an online web page where you can post comments. Yeah, what I post. My input is output to your screen. Yeah, somebody commented on this, and you can see that comment. Yeah, so it's not that strange. But what I could do now is add a script to my comment. Yeah, that's invisible in principle to the web page that is displaying it, but it can do something harmful. And so it also should be checked. Let me go to the example here. Here we have a comment. Thanks for this information. It's great. And then we add a script to that. Yeah, and that script is doing something harmful. It's looking at copying cookie documents. And so that could be information in the cookie that reveals something about my identity, for example. Yeah. So this is something that we wouldn't want. Well, if we would see this input, obviously, we could detect that is wrong. If I write it in this way, it's less obvious. At the very least, it's less obvious what it is doing. Personally, if I would see something like this, I would think it's fishy anyway. Yeah? But I can hide my purposes in particular encodings that the website understands. Yeah? Doing exactly the same, except that the smaller than is character 60, the as is character 115, etc. I just encoded it in a way that just obfuscates the actual meaning. Yeah, and by checking that the output indeed is not of the input indeed is not containing any of these scripts, it's just text, then I can confirm that it is correct. So what we need to do when we do secure programming, we need to validate the input at any time. So any input should be validated. Doesn't matter what kind of input. If I ask for a number, I should validate that also. If I ask for any type of data, I should check that indeed the input conforms with that data with the format that I want. What is wanted, yeah, as I said. That's one way, checking everything. What we also could do is check if there's some kind of dangerous input. Yeah, okay, so somebody could give input which is not valid and that could crash the program, but at the very least nothing serious is going to happen if I check if there is dangerous value. So in the previous example, if I'm looking for this script, yeah, okay, once I notice that is in there in the in the text, then I could remove it, but other things could still be valid. Yeah, so we only accept saved data, and that's has a higher, at least a higher possibility of the program remaining secure. Yeah. Unicode is used to. As I said, there is a growing number of different characters that is available. Unicode is a coding for those. They're using 16-bit values for characters. UTF-8 is actually encoding in different ways. A character will be encoded using 1 to 4 bytes, and actually characters can be encoded in different ways. So the same character can be encoded in 2, 3, maybe even more ways. Generally, the assumption is that the shortest of these encodings will be the correct one, will be the one that people have to use. But actually, there's no penalty for using a different encoding. Yeah, and if I'm only checking for the shortest, which is the one that people should use, yeah, I might miss out something. And an attacker could, in fact, use a longer encoding just to fool the system. So in safe program, what we could do is just transform everything back to one single representation and then check if that representation is secure or not. So that makes the work of the attacker more difficult. Numbers, as I said, again, we ask for a number and we expect some particular number. Maybe we expect a positive value below, I don't know, 100. If all of a sudden I give a negative value, negative numbers are encoded with the first bit set, just to show that they are negative, if we have signed numbers. Yeah, all of a sudden I get a relatively high value. It's actually minus one or whatever, but it looks like a high positive value. Yeah, so to check if the number is maybe above 100 will actually be true, but it is a negative number, so it will fail at some other point. Yeah, so checking for signs and checking for the length of the bits, checking for the type of number, again, is very important. And so the interpretation should be correct. Yeah? So validating input is actually the most important part in writing secure software. There's more, of course. Let's look at writing safe program code. In the programming languages that you use, how many of you are writing in machine language code? No, I didn't think so. Did you ever learn it or? Huh? Okay. I did. I use it a bit so much in the old days. But the language that you're writing, C, Java, whatever, PHP, that has to be translated to something that the computer understands. So it has to be translated to machine language, yeah, which then can be interpreted by the processor. But how secure are we that? First of all, our implementation of the algorithm. So we want to do some task. We have an algorithm for that. We have that on paper to start with. And then we go and code that into our favorite programming language. First of all, our algorithmic implementation of the algorithm, that should be correct. Yeah, if I just made a thinking error and implemented it in a wrong way, obviously it's not correct, maybe not secure even. Can we be certain that even if we have the correct implementation in our program, if we have coded it in the correct way, can we be sure that actually this translation to machine instructions is correct? We assume that all of the time, right? We assume that the compiler will take the high-level code and translate it in a correct way to the machine instructions. We are not sure about that. Difficult to check, I agree on that, but yeah, it is something that we have to take into account. We have to make sure that there is a valid manipulation of data. That we're not mixing between data types, for example. Mixing signed and unsigned numbers. Could go wrong there. Correct memory usage. Yeah, from the buffer overflow, we know that is also very important. Has to do with validation of the of the input, of course, partially, or validation of data in general. But also, if we don't use memory anymore, we should free it. We should just release it at that point in time. So some good programming development techniques. Programs might not handle all instances of a problem in the correct way. Maybe in most cases it does, but there could be a number of instances where our program would fail on a correct input. Yeah, not assuming a wrong input or whatever, malicious input, but it could be that our program, our algorithm implementation has some failure. It works okay in most cases, but in some cases it might fail. So that could result in something that an attacker could use. Examples in the book, you can read, I think, one or two examples about a wrong, or let's say not a wrong, a bad quality random number generation. And random number generation is very bad, but if I have a bad quality random number generation, I could start predicting what kind of random is being used. In many cases, it's not that big a deal. In some cases, it could result in something disastrous. If I generate random numbers for keys, cryptographic keys, I'm in big trouble. Yeah? Data might look random. Output of the number generator might look random. Yeah, but it has to be tested. Often a random number generator is started up. Apologies. I forgot where I was. Oh yeah, a random number generator is often started with some seed value, and then has some deterministic way of proceeding from there. If I can guess the seed value, or almost guess the seed value, I don't need to know it exactly, but if I know what up to a particular set of potential seed values, I can easily break this system. Debug and test code could be still in the release program. Yeah, debug and test code is in a program for the developer to make sure to test all the functionality of the program. Yeah, maybe a backdoor that gives me access to the program right away with bypassing the authentication mechanism, which is great because then whenever I start testing the program, I don't have to go over that process. I could just skip past that and I can test what I really want to test. If such code is left in the program afterwards, when there is a release version, obviously there is a big issue. Apparently it was used in the Morris worm. Correct machine instructions. As I said, it's maybe not so much ignored by most programs, but it's very difficult to check. Even if you look at the size of a program in machine code, could be a number of hundreds of kilobytes or megabytes even. Yeah, checking that is a really big task. Yeah, we assume that the compiler does as it should do. Yeah, but big organizations might in fact create loopholes in the compiler that could add malicious code that could be used afterwards. Specifically, if we talk about high-level security, we talked about common criteria last week also. If we have very high level of security, this should be taken into account also. You can't get an EL7 when you don't check this kind of implementation. Interpretation of data. Data is nothing more than bits and bytes. It's stored on the hard disk or in the memory. It's just a set of bits, binary data. The way that I interpret it makes it look different. Yeah, so a number could have the same representation as some character, except I know that this byte I have to interpret as a number, and so it has this particular value. If I would interpret this byte as a character, it would have a different value. So we have to make sure that we interpret the data in the correct way. Different programs handle data in different ways. You have seen that in MATLAB. You could easily swap between a character and a number. Yeah, just take a character, character A, and add the value 0 to it, and all of a sudden it was a number. Yeah, we could do that. Not all languages, programming language will allow that. So you have more strict, which are probably more secure, but handling the data could then be more problematic from the purpose of the programmer. If it's allowed this, yeah, then it could be easier to program, but yeah, we have to be very clear about security issues there. It might be less safe. Memory usage, I think we talked about memory usage already before. Memory leak, I mentioned that a couple of minutes ago. If we are not releasing memory that has been used, yeah, at some point we could run out of memory. Yeah. Apparently modern languages handle that better than before. Then we have the interaction with the software interaction with the operating system, or maybe with other programs. All programs run on a particular machine. That machine runs an operating system, so all of the programs have to interact with that operating system, of course. If they have access to hardware, so for example, files on the hard drive, they have to go through the operating system. But my program is probably not the only one that is running and making use of, let's say, the hard disk. There are more processes or programs running that are demanding information from that same source all of the time. And it's the operating system that takes care of that. So there you can see this as multiple users, multiple programs, multiple applications or services using the same resources at the same time. And we have to take this into consideration when we are programming. Yeah, a check, if I make a check now and then act on the result of a particular check before I have further actions, that result could have changed. If I want to know if a file exists, and if not, I want to create it. Yeah, in between checking if the file exists and getting the return back, no, it doesn't exist, and actually executing the creation of the file, there could be somebody at that point in time just inserting that file, creating that file just before I want to create it, which could result then in an error in my program. Privileges. What we don't want is escalation of privileges. So what often happens is that an attacker tries to use the fact that a certain program or something runs with a higher privilege than what he is normally allowed, and just hack into that program and use the fact that he has higher privileges at that point in time. So we run the program with the least privilege needed for its functionality. We don't give a program more privilege than what it needs to do. For example, if it needs to read files, I can give it that privilege, but not write, for example. Yeah, if I would just say, okay, yeah, I'll give it read and write, actually an attacker could use that fact. If it just needs to read information from a database, for example, but not make changes to the database, we don't give it write access. Obviously, that's a lot of work. When I write a program, I have to determine what's the functionality of the program, what should the program do? And I should take that into account when doing the programming and giving the privileges. So it is obviously an extra work because we have to do that all of the time. More similar also, it should only access files, for example, that it needs to access. Maybe just a specific directory where all the information that program needs is stored. It can read that directory, it can't read any other directories. Even though it has read privileges, it could be only restricted to the files or directories that it needs to operate on. If I can read this database, doesn't mean I should be able to read that database. Programs use system calls, obviously. if we use a system call in a program, we assume that it does what we want it to do, what it normally does. But it could be that somebody changed that system call, rerouted that, or something like that. So we have to take that into account too. What happens if you're actually the program and it's not running in a trusted environment? What will happen then? For example, here is an example. I think that makes it clear. When we delete a file, you know what happens when I delete a file? In principle, the file is still on my hard drive. But actually, the only thing that is not even removed, but slightly changed, is in the directory table, the link to the starting point of the file is removed. That's all. But the information is still there. So if I would inspect at a low level the hard drive, I could find the information back. Okay, I don't want that. I want to delete the file, but in a secure manner, that actually the information is removed from the hard drive. So what's often done is that we have a pattern, a number of bit patterns, and we override the file with this pattern first. And then we override it with this pattern. Why is that? Because even if I override it once, still some traces of the original bit values are left. So I have to override it with a number of patterns a number of times. So here we have a program that does that. Right? We open the file, and then for each of these patterns, how many there are, I don't care, we go to the start of the file, and we override the file with that pattern, and then we take the next pattern, etc., etc. And when we have overwritten it a lot of times, we close it, and then we remove it, because then the pointer to that file is removed. But if somebody would look at the low level, yeah, you would find random patterns, right? So what's wrong with this program? What we actually assume here is that when we go to the start of the file and then we start overwriting it, we actually assume that the system will then, at that point in time, actually write those patterns on the disk. That's not the way your system works. System optimizes. So it has a buffer, and it stores that information in the buffer. Once the buffer is full, or once it's explicitly told, it will write it to the disk. Well, it didn't tell it here explicitly to write it to the disk. So maybe before the system can write it to the disk, some other processes might take up processing time. Yeah, and it's waiting. But I start overwriting it again with different values. And it says, oh, wait, you're overwriting it again. I'll wait a bit. Yeah, and I actually haven't done anything physically on the disk. Yeah, so here, a safer way. Not even, again, there are flaws in this one also. But I do the exact same. I override it with a pattern. But then I explicitly say, put it on the disk now. Even this can go wrong. Even then, that process could be stalled because there are other processes going on. Yes, so be very careful. If we assume we use the override of the file here, we assume that the system will do that actually on the disk instead of just storing it in the buffer for further processing. Yeah, and then we start rewriting the buffer again, and actually no physical writing of the disk has changed, has occurred. Yeah, so here we can at the very least say, yeah, now put that information, put that buffer onto the disk. If you read the book, you will see that even this is not a secure version because there are different levels. On different levels, there are a number of processes. Temporary files. We use temporary files when we do programming, or we can use temporary files when we do programming. We need to store information. We don't want to keep it in memory. We just want to store it, and then other components of my program can use that, right? It must be stored in a file, but the file name must be unique. I can't store it in just any file because that might be in use by another program well, that might be existing already and can contain interesting information that or relevant information that not, must not be be overwritten. Yeah, so we have to be careful when we come up with a file name. Yeah, so we have to create a file name, which has to be unique, but it has to be predictable in the sense that my whole software should be able to use it, or maybe other software should be able to use it also. And as I said before, I check if that file name exists already, and if not, I'll create it. Yeah, in between that point that I say no, it doesn't exist, now I'll start creating it. An attacker could use that short time span to create a file already and to create some kind of error there. Yeah, maybe even there is not a breakdown of the program, but maybe because the attacker created this file, he has the read and write access to this file. Yeah, maybe my program still gets access without crashing, but I'm losing information to the attacker. So here, I think this was the safe. Yeah. The safe way to do it is just create it and see if that process worked. Yeah. Not first check if it exists and then create it, but just create it and see if the process worked. Very briefly, one page on. I'm actually good on time. One page on handling program output. Program output might be used further on in the program, or maybe next time or whatever. Could be sent over the net to somebody else in case of the forum that we discussed, where everybody could put in comments. Could be displayed on a screen or whatever. We have to consider, is it binary, is it text, is it a number, is it what kind of data are we talking about? And equally, as for the input of a program, we have to make sure that the output of a program conforms to what we think that it is. Specifically, if the output is related to input from an external source, or maybe some sources that we combine together and then put somewhere. Yeah, so we have to do also checking on the output of a program. Program must beforehand always determine what kind of output is admissible, is permissible. If any data that should be outputted is not conforming with the particular format that we expect, it has to be filtered, of course. Either it should not output, or it should remove insecure parts or whatever. As I said, very short on output. Any questions? Okay. Then so far the software security. In the next presentation, I will go into yeah, there is a question. Yeah. This one. This one or this one?
Yeah, both of them.
Okay. Yeah, that is in principle. I'm not sure if this indeed doesn't work on a solid state drive, but it could be a disk that, anyway, even if a new version of a file is saved, it could be on a different location. Yeah, and then mark the old location as unused or something like that. Yeah, so if an operating system or if a particular type of drive is doing that, yeah, then this would not work anyway. Yeah, correct. Yes. Okay, let's continue at 12:15, and then we'll talk about operating system security. Okay, let's continue with operating system security. Okay, when we look at an operating system, there are various layers that we actually can see, and the security depends on hardening each of the layers separately, but also the security from the lower layers that is transformed. So here we have a very schematic overview of a system. We have the physical hardware, on top of that is the operating system, and then application run on top of that again. It was shown in a report that actually a small number of hardening measures could prevent a large number of attacks. There are more than these top four strategies, but even these, just these top woods would already prevent 85% of known attacks. So these four strategies are one is approved applications, so not any applications, but those that are pre-approved. Is anyway very important, so we need to do that, both applications and operating systems. Restricting administrative privileges, of course, as an administrator you need to do specific tasks that not every user has to do, and if user has to do it, then not all of the time. If I need administrative privileges to install new software, sure, that's okay. But once I installed it, I have to go back to my normal user privileges. And creating a defense in depth system. So just these four strategies will give a less chance of being attacked. Let's put it like that. When we are starting a new system, we have to take into account that the system might be already compromised during the installation of the system and patching it up to all the known patches. Yeah. Building, deploying a system should be planned. So it's not just something we start to do, we should really make a good plan for that. And there are many things that we have to consider in this respect. If we look at the full process, we must look at the risks that we have, and it's a terrible sound. We must look at the risk and plan the system deployment, secure the operating system and the application that we need to run on the system. Critical content must be secured, network connections must be protected, and all the processes that run on there. So the plan is always the first step, obviously. That's not just in this case, it holds for a number of things. If you're writing software, you first start planning it. What should be the components before you start coding it? In the planning process, we need to look at the security requirements for the system. Yeah, depending on what the security requirements are, we have to adjust our plan. We need to identify appropriate personnel and training to install and manage the system, and it should include a security assessment of the organization also. Our aim is, in this particular case, to maximize security. Preferably at minimal cost, but yeah, security will cost anyway. Yeah, but having the same level of security at a later point in time, if we do a bad planning, will probably cost more. We consider things when we do planning. I will not go into all of these. Let's see. For example, here, how the users will be authenticated. That could be a part of the planning. Yeah, are they using a password? Are you using a token? Maybe biometrics? Maybe different levels for different users? Who will administer the system and how will they manage? Will we have local administration? Maybe we can even allow remote access of an administrator to a system. Yeah, things that these kinds of things need to be thought of ahead of time. The first step in having a secure system is making sure that the installation is secure. So we have to install the operating system and run all the patches that are available for that at the point of installment. Then we have to look at the configuration of the operating system. We should not just use the default configuration. We should configure it to the needs, and the needs are described in the plan that we had. So we must remove, or we should remove, unnecessary applications. Yeah, if the operating system comes with a number of services, maybe I don't need all those services. Yeah, then I remove the ones that I don't need. Why? Because I don't need them anyway. And if they remain, they can only be used for an attack. We have to configure users and groups and what permissions these users and groups have and which user is in which group. We do want to install additional security controls, antivirus, firewalls, whatever, intrusion detection systems, on top of the operating system. And then last but not least is also to test. Now we think we have built a secure system, we have to test it. Did we actually install it as we planned to install it? Yeah, maybe we detect some vulnerabilities. So we do have to do some testing once all the installation is finished before we start deploying it. When we do the installation of a system, preferably we do that online, or at least on a restricted network. Yeah, if we install it connected to the internet, we could be right away installing all the malicious software. Yeah, so we do that in a protected environment, a restricted environment at the very least. Only when the full installation is ready, so the configuration, the additional software, security software, the testing, when all of that is done, we can deploy it in a less or in a more hostile environment, in a less secure environment. Should install I mentioned that before, should install the minimal necessary system. Yeah, any service, any application, anything that is not needed, I should remove. Yeah, if at some point I'm installing software that I need on the system and I need to use Word on this system, I should not just install the full MS Office software. Yeah, I should install Word. PowerPoint, Excel, whatever is not needed on this system, I restrict to what I want. Same for the operating system. The overall boot process must also be secured, obviously. Yeah, if the boot process can be compromised, then again, this operating system can be compromised. We talked about that last week. No, 2 weeks ago, I think. If we need additional drivers, we should check the code or check the integrity of the provider. I think that actually holds for the full operating system. Again, like with the compilers that translate our code into machine code from last presentation, yeah, it same holds here. We do trust that the compiler does the work as it should do. We do trust that the operating system, maybe it's not completely secure, but patches will be there. There will be no deliberate backdoors or whatever in there. Yeah, but when we have additional drivers, again, we have to look extra carefully at if there's something, if all of that is secure, has to be validated. It's critical that the system is kept up to date. All patches, certainly all security-related patches, should be installed immediately. Yeah, the sooner I install a patch, the shorter the time the system is vulnerable to a particular bug. If we, however, have a system that's a production system that should run 24/7, I should not just install the patch right away because that might compromise the availability. I should try that out on a test system, and then once it works, I should install it on the real system. Obviously, this should be in a timely manner. Can't do that. I'll wait for the patch. Yeah. You should do that also immediately, making sure that the system is as up to date as possible. Remove unwanted parts. Anything that is available on the system and not used can be used by an attacker. So again, back to the system planning, back to the first step. What does this system need to do? What is needed to do that particular task? So that's part of the planning already. When we talk about configuration, yeah, we don't need to stick to the default configuration. It's easy. Yeah, for a home user, it should be very easy to just use the default configuration, which is often very good for usability. Yeah, but in secure systems, we have to look at the configuration and make sure that it is such that the system is as secure as possible. Not all users with access to the system will have the same access to all the data. Even users in similar roles will have access to different resources or maybe to the same resource but with different privileges. Yeah, so we have to figure out beforehand what user needs to access what kind of files, or maybe even specifically what files, what group of users need that. Elevated privileges should be restricted to only those users that require them. Yeah, me as a professor here, I can install my own software here. Yeah, if you have a secure environment where people just work on a computer, yeah, maybe they don't need to do that. So we'll take away that privilege. Yeah, if you need new software, the administrator will come and will install it on your machine. Yeah, so not everybody needs to be able to have a higher level privilege at a point in time. So we have to look at what categories of users are there. How can we group them? What are the different types of users that we have? What privileges should these groups or users have? What types of information can they access? Or even maybe specifically what information? Yeah, a data processor must have access to databases, yeah, but not maybe all of the databases. And when we are planning, you have to think about how to do the authentication, how to make sure that in fact the correct user is using the machine. There are some default accounts generally on a system. Yeah. Do we need them? Can we remove them? Yeah, there should be the user account. There should be probably an administrator account. Should there be a guest account on this machine? No, I don't think so. We can remove it. Yeah. Again, the least number of accounts on the machine, the least that can go wrong. Everything that is not used can only be used by an attacker. Okay, in the previous slide, we were defining what groups of users we had, what types of users we had, and what groups of users we had. Yeah, now we also have to define these users and these groups. What kind of information can they access, or what files exactly can they access? This is not something that you have to come up with completely by yourself. There are already guidelines of how to harden the system. Yeah, so just follow those guidelines and then adapt it to the particular needs of the organization. Installation of additional security controls, we mentioned that. You have to think about antivirus. You have to think about intrusion detection system, firewalls, either network-based or host-based. application whitelisting, what applications can you use. Also, you have many applications that can do the same thing. Yeah, if you look at reading a PDF document, showing a PDF document, there are many types of software that can do that. Yeah, which one am I going to use in my organization? And then the testing of the system. Yeah, before we can deploy a system, we have to test it. As a final step, we have to see if all the installation and configuration is done in the correct way. So we have to test for that. And maybe if there are vulnerabilities on the system. Yeah. So even though we did the best that we could, maybe we can detect that, hey, there is something that we overlooked altogether. Again, not something that you have to come up all from scratch. There are guidelines on how to test the system also available. You can do the testing either automatically or semi-automatically or maybe completely manual. That's all up to you. And obviously, we should do it right after you finish the installing in the hardware. Yeah, we don't wait. We don't deploy it first and start testing afterwards. We do that right away before we do the deployment. And we do it periodically. So this is something that it's not just a one-time thing, but repeatedly we test the security of a system. Yeah, so in principle, everything that I discussed leads to deployment of a system, but it doesn't stop there. Yeah, it's not like, okay, now I have a secure system. That will be secure for the rest of my for the rest of the time. We have to continuously look at the system security. So we have now an operating system, which is hopefully secure. We're going to install applications, and we have to look at application security also. In principle, what we did for the operating system, a very similar track can be followed for the software. Yeah, we don't do that in a completely open organization or open network. We do it in a restricted environment. There we install the software to make sure that we install what we want to install. We do it in a minimalized way. We look at the configuration. So all of the steps we had before, we're repeating them here. Not for the operating system, but then for the application. We install only what is needed. Yeah, that system has a particular functionality, so we'll install software that can do that. Yeah, we don't install whatever software that is not needed. Again, as I said, if we need Word, we don't need to install PowerPoint on top of that. Well, beside that, we don't have to install games or whatever. Yeah, no need. Once we have detected, once we have identified what software needs to be run on the system, we can install that, and then we can do the configuration and the updating of the software also. Again, software needs to be patched also. When we look at the configuration of an application, we have to consider what where the data can be stored that is needed to run the application. Making changes to the settings of the application, yeah, that's clear. What kind of access rights should be given to the application? Yeah, the application should obviously run in a desired way that the person behind it can use it. But it should not have too high privileges in accessing information, accessing data. It should also, again, run with the least number of privileges. For example, I should be able to add information to a database. I should not be able to read from the database. So that I don't give the application the read access to that database. Encryption. When we talk about securing an application, we have to think about encryption too. Encryption of either data that is stored or data that is in transit. It depends on the protocol. We have to consider things as key management, signing of public keys, secure storage of symmetric keys. Anything related to the key management comes on top of the encryption, of course. We can look at maybe completely encrypted file system, or maybe just having it's not there. Over there. Or maybe just encrypting the full file system, the full disk, or maybe encrypting just files or whatever. That's all up to the one planning. Okay, so we have our operating system, which we made secure, and we install the applications, and we configure them in a secure manner, and access rights and everything, and then we can start using our system. Yeah, but then obviously comes the maintenance. So we have to make sure that the system, which is secure initially, stays secure over its lifetime. So this is something that we continuously have to do. Monitoring and analyzing log information. The system will log what it is doing. We'll come to logging in a minute. Yeah, and we have to go over these log files and see if something is going on. Can we detect that there are issues with the security of the system? So we have to analyze the log file. We have to perform backups. Sure, I can assume that this system is safe, better safe than sorrow. Yeah, if something happens, even if it's an unintentional crash of the system, the data should be available later on. We should also plan for recovery from a security compromise. We cannot guarantee, even with a secure as possible system, that there will not be a compromise. So how should we recover from that? It's more a policy thing, so we'll not go into details there. We should test the system. Not just, as I said at the beginning, once the system is built up, we should test regularly to see if changes have occurred. See if we can detect vulnerabilities, see if the system still performs as it should perform. We should patch. New patches are released for software all of the time. Patch Tuesday for Windows, I think. So we should patch the operating system. We should patch the software that we're using continuously. So check and see if the configuration is still as desired. All of that should be in there. So logging, we mentioned that. We should do logging in of the operations of a system. We can use that log to see if processes are not running as it should be. We could maybe see if there is a particular attack going on, or an attempt to an attack going on, which could then lead to a change of the configuration of the system to prevent that. Logging by itself can't prevent something going wrong. Logging is just storing a trace of what has happened on the system. And so it will not prevent an attack, but it can help in determining what has been going on with the system afterwards. So you must make sure that our log file contains the information that we can use to react to anything that's happening to the system. Yeah, we can log at many different levels. We can log at system, network, or application level. We can log many things. We should find a good midway in terms of the amount of information that has been logged and the use that we can get of the log files. If we log everything, yeah, that will be a huge log file. Analyzing that will be very difficult. And there is also a specific amount of space reserved for a log file. If I log everything, yeah, that will fill up very quickly, and it will start overwriting the oldest data right away, and I might actually lose relevant data because I'm logging information that is not really needed. So I also must make sure that there is sufficient space allocated for the log file. Automated analysis is preferred. If you have a huge log file, then obviously you don't want to do that manually. Yeah. It's not on this. You should indeed very much security integrity. Not that an attacker comes in and then changes the log file because to remove all of his malicious activity. Yeah. So the log file should be something that is that has very high integrity. Very good. Backup, we mentioned that. Backup and archive in principle. Very much related, but still a slightly different goal. A backup is more or less if I lose a file here and now that I'm working on, an active file, to say, I should be able to get back to a status I was in 10 minutes ago or yesterday or maybe even last week, depending on how much data I am willing to lose. Archive is more like a not so much documents that you work on all of the time, but for legal aspects, documents that are in a more or less final state to have them available. Maybe not just legal, maybe also operational, but this is often data that you're not working on a daily basis. And that's where the backup comes in. But in principle, the way that we do archive or backup, it's similar. Is obviously critical. Who does that, by the way? Oh, cool. More than I expect. Depending on your own personal needs, if you're writing your master thesis at some point in time in the future, if you back up once a week, that might be a lot of information that you're losing. Yeah. So storing that information on something that backs up every day or maybe every hour or maybe every version, that could be really helpful. There might be legal or operational requirements for the retention of data, so that's why we do the archiving. When we look at what we do backup or archiving, let's talk about backup. Should be online or offline? Yeah, if it's online, if I lose this file, I can get it back really quickly. Yeah, but if it's online, there is a potential for an attacker to access it also. So yes, offline is more secure. Might be more secure. But yeah, people might have to wait a bit longer for getting files back. Should I store it locally or should I have it at a remote site? Again, if something happens, if I have it here close by, it's easy to get a backup, to get the information back. If I have it, specifically if I have it offline and at a remote site, somebody has to get the backup tape, has to come back. It all takes a lot of time. Yeah, but if the building here burns down and I lose screen and the backup, I have nothing. Yeah, again, depending on what the needs are for the organization, you have to make choices between these. Yeah, so there is a trade-off between ease of implementation and cost versus more security and robustness. Linux, Unix security, I'll leave that to yourself to read. I will go to Windows security briefly. Batch management, you know all this from Windows. That's Tuesday, once every month or something like that? I actually don't know. Whenever I see something coming, install, and that's what you want. Application, so third-party application, you should also do the patching there. If possible, turn on the automatic patching, or at least the automatic notification that you know, and then when you see something, patch immediately. If we look at Windows, apparently it implements discretionary access control. Remember that from 2 weeks ago? That's the one we started with. If we look at the system, Vista and later, had also mandatory integrity control. So not just access control, but also integrity control, following this BIBA model that we talked about. In this objects have a label related to the integrity of it, so low, medium, high, and apparently system integrity. And I can operate only on objects that have at most the security label that I have. So if my security label would be medium, I cannot do anything with an object that is labeled high. So the log file, apparently, at least in Windows, should have integrity. Probably it will have, what was it called, system integrity, whatever it was called. Yeah, so the highest level of integrity. Windows systems define privileges. They are granted to a particular user account, so to a person. Examples are the privilege to do backup, or the privilege to do change of system time, or whatever. Not all privileges are considered. Other way around. Some privileges are considered dangerous. Yeah, and if I have a privilege that is considered dangerous, could be backup, whatever. Yeah, if I consider that dangerous, I'll make sure that there is only a limited set of people that gets that privilege. Yeah, so we restrict the privileges, and we have to grant them with care. Maybe people need to do the backup, and even though it is considered dangerous, I have to give it to many people, because the alternative is that they don't do backup and they might lose data. Yeah, but we have to take care. You have to consider this in the planning phase. Windows uses access control list, and in the access control list there is actually deny has a preference over granting access. And so, for example, if I'm a member of a group and a group has access to a particular object, but the access control list denies me access to that object, even though I'm a member of that group and all other members can access that object, I can't. Deny takes preference over granting access. They have user account control, which gives users administrative rights, but only for the time that they need it. I'm using the computer with my own user privilege. At some point I need to install software, and I have been granted to be able to do that. Yeah, then I will go up to administrative right for the time of that install, for the time that I need it. This is to make the window of opportunity for an attacker as small as possible. If I would just get administrative right and keep it from there on, yeah, then obviously an attacker can at any point attack me. Well, if I have it for a limited period of time, yes, that is his window of opportunity. And after that, I will go back to my normal user rights, where yeah, he might not be able to do what he wants to do. Windows has the configuration of applications for a large part, at least, in the registry, which is the database of keywords and key values. And you can have a look at that. Software can just install just add to the registry to the configuration of its own program. Yeah, if you want, you can do the changes of the registry also by hand. You try regedit, you can get access, but obviously you have to be careful, because you can really mess up the system there. And then finally, on Windows, we need to not just trust the Windows Defender, or whatever it's called. We have to install our own virus scanners and whatever we need. But we have to be careful when we install that. Make sure that particular third-party software does not fight too much with the Windows Defender. Yeah, so we have to ensure that the products are compatible. We can use encrypted file system, or even do the full disk encryption in Windows. And there is something called Microsoft Baseline Security Analyzer, which is software that does testing for you also. Has anybody ever tried that or not? Okay, me neither. So I can't say anything more about that. Okay, in a few minutes I want to say something about quickly about virtualization. So virtualization is using virtual machines such that software can live, or maybe a full operating system can live in this virtual machine. Doesn't directly has access to the hardware, but it has to use an intermediate layer to get access. Multiple operating systems working on the same computer. Obviously, an extra layer will be introduced in my system, which could raise some additional security concerns. On the other hand, some security concerns are taken away by doing this. There are two types: application virtualization and full virtualization. So, in the first one, we can run specific applications in a virtual machine. In the second one, we actually have a number of operating systems running in parallel on a system. And there will be a so-called virtual machine monitor, or called hypervisor also, that actually controls the access of these virtual machines to the hardware and the relation between them. This is a picture. This is the full virtualization. So we have different operating systems on one machine. So we have the hardware of the machine. We have the hypervisor in between the hardware and the guest operating system. So if this guest operating system can't actually see the actual hardware, but it can see a representation of the hardware, it looks like it sees the actual hardware, but that is a representation in the hypervisor. When it accesses the hardware in the hypervisor will then access the actual hardware and will control the hardware in between the different operating systems. That's mostly seen on servers, apparently. This is mostly seen on clients where we have the normal host operating system, and on top of that we run a hypervisor with a number of guest operating systems where we can run a number of applications that we want. Well, we have normal user application that run on the host operating system. Again, if we want to use virtualization, either full or application virtualization, we have to do careful planning again. From the beginning on, we have to do the planning. All that I told about installing an operating system in a secure manner, installing software in a secure manner, doing all the testing, doing the configuration, doing the patching, etc., all that holds again for the virtualization. Same story. So in principle, everything that I just said holds, but the hypervisor security is now added into this full story. All the rest is there. A hypervisor should be secured against using a process similar to securing the operating system. So we do the same thing: we plan, we install, we patch, we configure, we test, all of that. So be installed in an isolated environment, configured, monitor, test to see if it's installed in the correct way and configured in the correct way, and if there's vulnerabilities. Monitor also when in use, same as that the testing was on an operating system was there when in use. Should be accessed only by authorized administration. Yeah, again, who do we give access to the hypervisor? Well, at the least number of people that need access. If all of the users have access, then that could be a weakness of the system again. We have to think about, again, the administration. Should we do that local or should we do that remotely? I don't think I've mentioned that too much in the operating system, but the same holds. If we have local administration, if the administrator has to come to my machine to do the administration or the configuration of the hypervisor or the operating system or the software running on it, doesn't really matter. That obviously is more secure than when it can be done remotely, because we have an extra channel that can be hacked again or can be misused. Yeah, but somebody coming obviously is not as user friendly for the people working in the administration. Yeah, so these are considerations which hold for the hypervisor as much as for the operating system and applications. And that was actually the last thing. Actually, twice, quite on time this week. Good. I'm getting good at this. Any questions on operating systems? Okay. Next week, we'll do chapters 8 and 9, which is intrusion detection and firewalls, intrusion prevention. That will be the last presentation that I will give the week after. It will actually be Socrates Katsikis, who will give a presentation on critical infrastructure security. The week after that, I saw in time edit that it was planned. I didn't plan anything in either in Blackboard or in my own calendar. But what we could do, that would be the 1st of December, what we could do, if you want that at least, I could give you a trial exam. Okay. So on the 1st of December, there will be a trial exam for the people in class. I can't provide that to the people outside, of course. The idea will then be that you will get an exam. You will work on it for, let's say, the 2 hours in class, so I'll make it appropriate size. We'll work on it, and that will be an exam that will be of similar settings of what it will be in the real exam. Yeah, except smaller. And then we'll use the exercise session afterwards to go over the exam. Yeah, so really for 2 hours you will get the exam and you will work on it. Yeah? No books, of course. No. That's not on the... You don't have books, sir. No, it's in the quality system, so I can't change it now. Any questions? If not, thanks for being here today. And then that's it for today.